setup was far too elaborate for a spur-of-the-moment theft. An inside job, at the very least. Figure out who has that sort of connection to the family, Allegra's ex-husband, Remy said. The solicitor's investigator thought she was hiding something, and Oliver suspected he might be there. Sam added, not sure of his name, but he's certainly a good possibility. I'll touch bases with the investigator, Selma said. Back to Paris. How are you two doing on cash? We're fine. Remy managed to pick up a few thousand euros from the broker. Laszlo smiled. I dare say he wasn't too pleased about that. Unfortunately, his guards may have taken it out on our car. Are you returning it to the rental agency in Italy? Selma asked Sam. Considering our lack of finances, I think it'll be cheaper and safer to drive to Paris. I just need to figure out how to patch those bullet holes so they're not so obvious. I'd hate to get pulled over and have to explain how they got there.
Duct tape, Laszlo said. Just make sure it's the same color as the car.
Let me know where you end up dropping it off, Selma told Sam. Once we get the credit cards back on track, I'll notify the rental agency. And the insurance company. What about the jet? In hock at Ciampino. The crew took the petty cash and are probably waiting to hear from you.
We'll put that on our list, Selma said. Any idea where in Paris you're headed?
Remy read the address off the pad of paper. See if there's anything on Lorenzo Rossi at that location. I gathered he wasn't going to release the ghost until Oren's transfer cleared. Also, Sam said, check for connections near the coast. If he's fencing stolen property from other countries, especially the UK, he's going to have something near major shipping areas. Quick in, quick out.
We'll get on it, Selma said.
Thanks. And if I didn't mention it, Remy and I are glad to hear from the both of you. We were worried when we couldn't get in touch.
You were worried.
Selma sank back in her chair and looked over at Laszlo.
You should have seen us.
Laszlo gave a dry laugh, reached over and grasped Selma's hand, giving it a reassuring squeeze.
The worst thing that happened was, he said, we couldn't call for takeout. We did, however, raid the safe for petty cash.
Glad you're both okay, Remy said. We'll talk to you soon. They disconnected, and Selma gave a deep sigh. Noting Laszlo's expression mirrored hers, overwhelming relief that the Fargos were fine. A few seconds passed before either of them realized they were still holding hands. Letting go, they looked at each other, both feeling a sense of embarrassment as they scooted closer to their own desks.
Well then, Laszlo said, I'll give the banker a call and see if he has made any further progress.
Selma picked up the slim volume.
Guess I better get back to the journal to see if Jonathan Payton ever rescued Miss Atwater.
Chapter 58 Journal of Jonathan Payton, 5th Viscount Wellswick, 1906 'Twas the longest 15 minutes of my life, hoping that Miss Atwater had not been injured, certain she must be frightened beyond all belief. As I rounded the corner and saw the darkened building of my father's warehouse, I wondered if I'd misunderstood everything. Surely if anyone had been there, there'd be lights coming from within. Wary, I crouched down behind a short brick wall and worked my way in that direction. Something moved in the shadows ahead. Two men were standing at the garage door, one acting as lookout while the other worked at the lock. I heard the scrape of wood as they slid open the large door, wherein I saw the moonlight gleaming off the gray bodywork of the missing Rolls-Royce. Gripping the brass handle of my cane, I watched for a few more seconds. Only two thieves. Thank heavens. I started forward. I wouldn't do that. I turned, surprised to see my cousin. Richie? Why... Only then did I notice the gun pointed at me. Until that moment, even with the incriminating evidence of seeing that car in our warehouse, I realized I'd been holding on to the belief that Reginald was innocent. I could think of no reason as to why he'd stolen the car.
Surely he knew that with the theft of the ghost and the imminent harm to the company as a result, we'd lose everything we'd invested. It wasn't so much the loss of my own fortune. It was the families on our estate who'd lose their homes, and the children at the orphanage. So many who'd be displaced. I don't understand, I said.
You never did.
Reggie stepped forward, his nose wrinkling in distaste as he smelled the scent of garbage clinging to my clothes. He nodded toward the warehouse.
Inside. I know how much you hate for anyone to cause a scene.
The confirmation that my cousin was behind this theft hit me hard.
I trusted you.
Reggie gave an unsympathetic smile. Your misfortune, it seems. Had you been smart, you would have stayed in the garbage heap and slept it off. You would have awakened merely a poor man, not a dead man. No matter. He motioned with the pistol, pointing toward the garage. Move. I'd rather not be the one to shoot you, but I will if need be. Where's Miss Atwater?
Safe enough. For now.
I promise you, though, if you fail to cooperate, she'll be the first to go. He raised the gun, and I started walking toward the building. As I neared the warehouse, Reggie's two men, both armed with knives, stood just inside the door. I gripped my father's cane, fearing not only what they'd do to me, but also what might befall Miss Atwater.
Why?
I asked again as Reggie pointed for me to enter.
Why do you think? You've always had everything.
I?
Nothing.
I thought you should know what it felt like.
But we've always provided for you.
Your father hated me. Hated my father to his dying day.
You're wrong.
Eddie, Reggie called out, pushing me into the doorway. My head still muddled from the caution, I stumbled forward. A heavy-set man with a jagged scar on his cheek grabbed me and threw me to the ground. My father's cane flew from my hand. Before I could reach for it, the scar-faced man dropped down, digging his knee into my back.
Mac, he called out.
The other man, Mac, I presumed, tossed a heavy rope toward us, dust kicking up as it landed near my face. Eddie tied my hands behind my back, then wrapped a length of the same rope around my feet, drawing them back. When he finished, he stood over me, his face filled with disgust as he kicked me in the gut.
Enough, Reggie said.
The clip-clop of horse hooves caught his attention, and he peered out the door.
The lorry's here.
Mac and Eddie left me and rolled the carriage door wide open. Reggie picked up the lantern from the floor, the light flickering on the cobblestones as he stepped outside. He called back to the two of them.
Get the chest out, and careful with it.
Where do you want us to stow it? Eddie asked.
Put it in the Grey Ghost. Should be safe enough in there.
The two men dragged a small chest from beneath a tarp. Whatever was in it was heavy, and the two had difficulty lifting it.
Recognition hit me when Reggie's lamplight flickered on a gold-leafed royal crest on the outside of the chest.
The train robbery, Reggie?
You?
My cousin looked surprised.
You think I'm not capable of something that daring?
That always was your problem. He walked over to the Grey Ghost, standing aside as Eddie and Mac brought the chest over. By tomorrow night, once I deliver the 40-50 to my buyer, your father's investment in Rolls-Royce Limited will be for naught. And with my profits from the robbery, I'll have enough cash to buy back Peyton Manor and all the lands your father stole from mine. What I won't be doing is wasting my money on those charities you support.
The children,
that orphanage your father started will be the first to go.
Finley,
Reggie called out to the man in the driver's seat of the lorry.
A hand!
The man secured the horse's reins, jumped down to pull out the ramps from beneath the lorry's bed, before climbing up to work the winch. He drew the length out, tossing the end to Eddie as my cousin walked around the vehicle, the lamp's light reflecting on the polished gray paint. Eddie secured the winch to the ghost, and Finley started pulling it up.
Does this car really work?
Finlay asked as Eddie and Max started pushing the car toward the lorry. Why don't we just drive it out of here?
And get caught, Reggie said. Don't be an idiot. If a night watchman hears that engine starting, he might come round to investigate.
Load it up, put the chest inside, and get the tarpaulin over it before someone sees it.
Once the car was safely on the lorry, Reggie stood aside as Eddie and Mac hefted the chest, carrying it up the ramp. Whatever was in it was heavy, and Eddie nearly lost his grip, the chest slamming into the bed of the lorry.
I heard the ring of metal hitting metal, imagining what sort of treasures would be in a royal chest. Gold and jewels, perhaps.
What about your cousin? Eddie asked when they were finished loading the chest. What are we going to do with him?
Kill him, of course. My cousin's emotionless voice sent a chill down my spine. Quietly, though. Eddie looked over at me as though contemplating how best to carry out my demise. When he turned away to help the others cover the car with the tarpaulin, I shifted, trying to get to my cane, which had landed somewhere behind me. I felt it with my fingertips, managing to hit the release for the dagger hidden in the shaft. But then I heard the soft scrape of footsteps. As I twisted around, I saw a flash of white from the corner of my eye. Whoever it was grabbed the cane from my fingers, drew the hidden dagger from the handle, and clamped a hand over my mouth.
Chapter 59. Arthur Oren passed through airport security and walked to the executive lounge to wait for his plane back to the UK. If he'd had his way, he'd be in Paris to personally take possession of the car today, not Monday. The video he'd seen before bidding on the car had erased all doubts that he was looking at the ghost. Still, it galled him that he'd had to pay such an exorbitant price to recover the very car that he'd stolen himself, and it angered him even further that he had to wait for his bank transfer to clear before he could view the car in person. Still, it was now a matter of a day or two before he'd have the ghost safely back in the UK. Only then would he learn the secrets she held. Assuming the Fargos didn't interfere. The phone buzzed in his pocket. Colton. At last. You got my message?
I did, Colton said. It was the Fargos who broke into Rossi's office, wasn't it?
From the description they gave me, there's no doubt. I'm sending you a photo from their security cameras.
Oren's phone beeped with the incoming message. He opened it. Saw a grainy photograph of a man and a woman climbing on the balconies of the Rossi Villa.
So we know the Fargos were there, he said. The bigger question is, what are you doing to make sure neither of them interfere in our plans again?
To start, we've tapped into the phones of Oliver and the mechanic.
Weren't they in Milan?
They are heading south again, probably to meet up with the Fargos. When they do, we'll deal with them.
Had you dealt with the Fargos back when I asked you to, we wouldn't be having this conversation, would we?
Colton cleared his throat. As I said, Peyton and the mechanic are heading south. The path of their travel indicates they're on a train to Rome. Bruno and one of Rossi's men will follow them to wherever the Fargos are holed up.
In Rome?
Two women walked into the lounge, both rolling small luggage bags alongside them.
You really think you're going to be able to do anything with that many people around?
I assure you that the location makes no difference whatsoever.
I want them. Oren, seeing both women watching him, stopped just short of saying the word dead.
He forced a slight smile, lowering his voice as the women took a seat a few feet away.
Just see that the job's done. I'm tired of waiting.
He disconnected, then took a better look at the digital photo that Colton had sent of the security camera from Rossi's villa. Though grainy and dark, the sight of the woman's face shot a feeling of dread through him.
It couldn't be.
The woman from the elevator? But she spoke no English. Her accent was impeccable. She what? Pretended to be Italian?
The knowledge of how close she'd been to him sent his thoughts racing. He wasn't used to this sense of panic or the feeling that he was losing control. He wanted to throw his phone across the room, to smash something, anything. The sight of the two women watching him forced him to take a calming breath. What he needed to do was re-evaluate. He hadn't gotten this far in life by letting his emotions rule him. He had only himself to blame. Recalling the photos that Colton sent in the original dossier on the Fargos, he opened that file, took a second look. The truth was, he hadn't given the photos more than a cursory glance. Who cared what the spoiled, rich wife of a multimillionaire looked like? How was he to know that this Remy Fargo was anything more than just a pretty face who could shoot straight? He stared at her photo a few seconds more, angry that he hadn't recognized her when she'd stood next to him outside of Rossi's villa. Of course, he'd had other things on his mind, like securing the ghost before someone else bid on it. A small consolation, and little he could do about it for now. As infuriating as it was that Colton once again had let the Fargo slip past him, Oren knew better than to voice his displeasure too much. Like it or not, he needed Colton. That didn't mean he intended to let Colton do as he pleased. Oren had Bruno to keep an eye on Colton's men, which meant there was little they could do without him knowing. Distrust, unfortunately, came with the territory. Someone had stolen the ghost from right beneath his nose, and when he found out who was responsible, he fully intended to exact his revenge. For now, though, the Fargos were his main concern. The photo of Remy on the balcony bothered him more than he wanted to admit. He didn't like the fact that they'd gotten that close without him knowing it. He'd like it a lot better when they were dead. Chapter 60 Remy joined Sam at the open window, where the early morning sun turned the fountain's shimmering mist to pale silver as it rose from beneath the two horses pulling Neptune on his shell-shaped chariot. The soothing sound of rushing water almost muted the voices of the dozens of tourists packed around the base, watched over by the two carabinieri officers whose patrol cars were parked nearby. They were apparently permanent fixtures during the daytime. I wonder how many reports those officers take each day. Pickpockets? Lost kids? When he didn't respond, she checked the direction of his gaze and noticed he appeared lost in thought. Sam? Sorry. I was trying to figure out how we can get out of here if Oliver and Chad are being followed. You don't think they'd come in from the direction of the Fountain Square, do you? I doubt it. The standard route for the taxis is to drop everyone near the front of our building. He walked to the window on their left, this one facing north. Remy followed him. The fourth floor gave them a clear view down the narrow cobbled street that led out to the main road. Within the few seconds they stood there, two taxis pulled up, dropping off passengers who came to see the fountain. What we need is a quick getaway. We don't want to be trapped up here if Oliver and Chad are spotted ringing the doorbell downstairs. Maybe we'll get lucky and they won't be followed. Not likely. It's the only way Bruno and company can find us. Too bad we couldn't slip Chad's and Oliver's phones in someone else's pocket, like we did at Castle Rising in King's Lynn. Except we were the ones doing the following. Sam's voice drifted off. He watched the taxi taking off with a new fare. Actually, you might be onto something there, Remy. Whose pocket are we slipping their phones in? Ours. You mean you want them to follow us? That's the plan. At least to start off with. Paris is a 15-hour drive from here. We get them to follow the phones for a few hours. I'm hoping we'll be halfway to France before they realize we're gone. Less than an hour after Sam outlined his plan, Chad and Oliver arrived in a taxi that let them off in the square of the small church across the street. Unfortunately, Bruno and his new partner, a blonde man neither of them had seen before, pulled up about a half block behind the church on the opposite side than Sam had predicted, cutting them off from the car he'd parked around the corner. Sam surveyed the crowded square, a look of concern on his face. We're going to need a distraction to get to the car. On it, Remy said, pulling out her phone. She called the emergency number, reporting two armed men standing in front of the building across from Santa Maria a Trevi Church. I heard them talking about shooting up the fountain. I saw a gun beneath their suit coats. 2 minutes later, the officers from the fountain rounded the corner, both looking in the direction of Bruno and his partner. Bruno suddenly stopped, as though realizing they were the focus of the officers' attention. That's them, she said to the woman on the phone. One of the officers touched his ear, adjusting his earpiece to hear the dispatcher. When Bruno's partner turned to run, the two officers tackled him. Bruno, however, took off in the opposite direction. One down, one to go, Sam said as Remy ended the call. Nice work. You get the car. I'll get Oliver and Chad before Bruno catches up to them. Remy pulled up a few minutes after that, glad to see Bruno was nowhere in sight. Good timing, Sam said as he slid into the front passenger seat and Oliver and Chad got in the back. She drove to Roma Termini. At the train station, Sam took Oliver's and Chad's phones, walked inside, and returned a few minutes later. One is on its way to Austria, the other to Germany. That should keep Bruno busy for a while. He opened the glove box and pulled out the tracking device Oren's men had hidden in their rental car. Might be a good time to reactivate this little thing before we take off. Remy looked over at him. You don't think he'll suspect that it's suddenly starting up? He might. But these things are designed to sleep if there's no movement, to preserve battery power. And what better place to wake it than where the phones were last seen? But where? Remy asked. Sam nodded toward the bus, and Remy smiled. Pick you up on the other side? See you there. Sam jogged over, pretended to drop something next to a bus scheduled for Naples, then planted the device. Why go to the trouble? Oliver asked when he got back in the car. Confusion, Sam said. Your phones are here. If Bruno's still tracking them, he'll end up at the train station, trying to find the both of you. And if we're really lucky, the device I stuck under the bumper of that bus will cloud things even more. Naples is a long way from Paris. So is Rome, Remy said. We better get started. Chapter 61 Sam took the first shift at the wheel, and minus a few breaks for food and fuel, they drove straight through, arriving in Paris a little after 2 in the morning. Once again, limited to cash only, Remy's friend Georgia was able to find them a Paris apartment in the 20th arrondissement. Situated in a working-class neighborhood, the second-story apartment offered a partial view of the Eiffel Tower from the kitchen window, provided they leaned to the left. Late the next afternoon, as Oliver and Chad returned from a trip to buy groceries for a late breakfast, Sam sat in the kitchen, looking over a map of Europe. Remy brought 2 mugs of coffee to the table, taking a seat next to him. What if he was lying about the location? In case he can't trust Oren, Sam replied. Exactly. How certain are we that the ghost's not in Paris? We can't be sure, Sam said. Still, the gray ghost isn't something you can hide in plain sight. A bit of a risky move to bring it this far inland. We need to think logically. He studied the map for possible routes. If we knew how he got it out of the UK, that might narrow down where he has it stored. So where would he keep his less than legitimate goods? Somewhere easy to get to, and easy to ship out after a sale, I'd think. We can safely assume they got the ghost out of London in a truck. From there, it's anyone's guess. They transport trucks through the Channel Tunnel, Remy said. That's the closest and fastest route from the London Motor Show. Oliver looked up from the cutting board where he was slicing fresh bread. Except, he said, the police were notified right away. The investigator told me that the first thing they were checking was transport trucks and containers headed to France. I'd think the tunnel would have been the first thing they checked, and the easiest. Sam drew an X through the London Eurostar route, then circled Dover. Good point. Less risky to send it to a major shipping port, where no one would notice one more container. "Calais is busy enough to escape notice," Chad suggested as he brought over the cut apples and the grapes. "I've taken the ferry over quite a few times." "That'd be my first pick," Sam said. "But we still have to find the specific facility Rossi's using, or it'll be like a needle in a haystack," Remy suggested. "Exactly. I doubt Rossi's got a website announcing which warehouse he's using for his stolen goods." "Of course, we're assuming he's using one of his own," Remy said. "High value and high risk. There's no way he's going to entrust it to anyone else." "So how do we find it?" Chad asked. "It's Sunday," Remy said. "What better time to visit?" "Might be a night operation," Sam asked. "What do you think, Remy?" "After a quick recon trip during daylight hours to see what we're up against, we can make that decision." Late that afternoon, they drove out to Rossi's business office. As they stood across the street, it didn't take long for Sam to discover that getting in after dark wasn't going to be as easy as they thought. The office was housed in a business district with high-level security, including a bank on the first floor of Rossi's building. "So much for that idea," Sam said. "That bank adds a layer of protection Rossi couldn't get anywhere else." Remy gave a facetious smile. "I suppose pretending to be from Orin's shipping company for a pre-inspection of the car would be too obvious." "Just a bit." Oliver looked relieved that they seemed to be backing out of the idea of breaking in. "So we are not coming back tonight?" "No." Sam examined the windows of the four-story structure. Rossi's export management company was on the third floor. Breaking and entering into a building containing a national bank is likely to buy us a few years in prison. All we can do now is come back in the morning when the place is open for business. "Cutting it short," Remy said. "They're meeting at 11. If we want access, that's our only choice." They returned the next morning at 8. The bank had its own entrance in the lobby. Those who were not bank customers had to check in with the security guard before being allowed to access the elevator. After watching the people going in and out of the lobby's front doors, Sam and Remy looked at each other, Sam saying, "You know what this place reminds me of? That time in Madrid?" Sam smiled. "I think we have our plan." Chapter 62 Allegra and Trevor spent most of their time on the couch, side by side, staring at the television. Though she tried to concentrate on the plot of the movie playing, she couldn't. Trevor, she was glad to see, laughed in all the right places. Somehow he was able to relax. The resiliency of teenagers. She prayed that when this was over, when she somehow found a way out of this, he'd have no lasting damage to his psyche. A knock at the door sent her heart leaping in her chest. Dex immediately reached for the gun in his waistband as he rose from his seat to see who was there. She grasped Trevor's hand, silently reminding him to remain still, to stay quiet. Not that he needed any warning. The bruise on his cheek from where Dex had struck him with the journal was fading, yellowing at the edges. Trying not to let her attention catch on it, she watched as Dex crossed the room, looked out the peephole, opened the door. After Frank walked in, Dex checked the street in both directions. Satisfied no one was out there watching, he closed and locked the door. About time. The broad-shouldered man's right arm still bandaged and in a sling. Apparently he'd been shot in a gun battle with the Fargos. A shame they'd missed, she thought as he scrutinized them. "Still here," he said to her. She ignored him. Kept staring at the television. Trevor did the same. "You want a beer?" Dex asked him. "And something to eat." Dex looked over at Allegra, then cocked his head in the direction of the kitchen. She immediately rose. "I'll make us lunch. Come help me, Trev." When Dex looked as though he was about to object, she said, "Where's he going to go?" "Go on," Dex said. Trevor followed her. While he got the bread, jam, and butter out, she opened a bottle of beer for Frank and an ale for Dex. "If he lets down his guard," she whispered, "you get out." "I'm not leaving you, Mum." "You are. What are you two talking about in there?" Dex yelled. Allegra mouthed, "Quiet," then took the bottles out to Dex and Frank.
Trying to find something to eat. Is bread and jam and butter okay?
Frank, who'd sprawled himself on the couch, put his feet up on her coffee table.
If that's all you have.
Dex grabbed the ale from her hand.
Make cheese sandwiches.
We're out of cheese.
Jam's fine, Frank said.
Not for me, Dex said. He wasn't a fan of sweets.
What else do we have?
Nothing.
Nothing for dinner. Or breakfast. I wasn't expecting Frank back so soon.
Blimey, Dex. You starving them on purpose. Send one of them to the store.
I don't trust them.
Well, I'd offer to go for you by the arm.
He pulled at the white sling.
Dex took a long swig of his beer.
Looks like we'll starve.
You could always go, Allegra said to Dex.
He narrowed his eyes at her.
Frank's here, she pointed out. He can stay with us.
Oh, I don't mind, Frank said.
Dex seemed to think about it, lowering his bottle to the table.
Yeah, okay.
They try anything. Frank slashed his finger across his neck, making her glad Trevor wasn't in there to see it.
I'll make a list, she said.
10 minutes later, Dex was gone. She breathed her first sigh of relief since this nightmare began, until she saw Frank resting his hand on the butt of his holstered gun.
Another sandwich, she asked.
I'll wait.
Beer?
Sure. She signaled for Trevor to stay at the kitchen table, as she opened another beer and brought it out to Frank.
How long do we have to stay here? She asked.
He took the bottle, gazing at the television.
Until we get the car back and find what's hidden in it. I mean, who knew?
Knew what?
There was a treasure somewhere.
In the car?
That'd be rich. Someone would have found it by now, don't you think?
How'd it get stolen?
Some train robbery back in the 1900s.
The car, I meant. The Grey Ghost.
Frank looked at her, his brows raising.
You're kidding, right?
As much as she wanted to tell him that she found none of this laughable, she dared not do anything to arouse his anger. Keeping her expression as calm as possible, she picked up Dex's half-empty ale and carried it to the kitchen, looking back at Frank.
I know how it was stolen from my uncle. After all, she played a small but major role in that crime.
But what choice did she have?
I was wondering how it was stolen from your boss.
You mean you really don't know?
He stared at her, shook his head.
That's rich.
A slow realization burned in her gut.
You and Dex?
Who else?
Are you insane? What happens when your boss finds out?
How would he do that?
I don't know. She couldn't believe what an idiot she was.
Clamping her mouth shut, she pretended to do a bit of cleaning, working her way to the coffee table, turning up the volume on the television as she slid the remote control next to a magazine, then picking up Frank's empty sandwich plate, returning it to the kitchen.
Trevor, come help me do the dishes.
Trevor pushed back his chair from the table and trailed after her. She turned on the water full blast, letting it run.
Do you think you can climb out the window upstairs?
It could only open a few inches, the crank having been removed, but she was certain he could force it open wider. The window frame was old, made of aluminum.
You can tie a couple of sheets together from the linen closet. I'm not leaving you here.
You have to, she whispered, looking back toward the living room. Frank's attention was on the television.
Your father helped steal Uncle Albert's car from the man who stole it to begin with. When that person figures it out, he'll send someone here to kill him. And us. Assuming...
She was about to say, your father, again, but stopped when she realized how horrible it sounded. As though this was Trevor's fault more than hers. The fault was hers. And hers alone.
Dex isn't right in the head. When this is over and he gets what he wants, he'll kill us.
She wiped away a few tears.
Please go.
Tie a couple of sheets together. I could bear anything except the thought of you getting hurt. Please.
What if something happens to you? He whispered back. How am I supposed to go on?
Because I love you. I will always love you. And you think about that every single day.
Mum.
Tears pooled in his eyes. Please. Please, Trev. He nodded, and she hugged him, amazed at how much he'd grown, feeling his warmth, his heartbeat against her ear, as she pressed her head against his chest. She wanted to remember this moment, everything about him, in case it was the last time. Finally, she pushed away.
Hurry.
Chapter 63. Frank walked in just as she turned toward the sink. What's going on? He asked.
Trevor doesn't feel well. I told him to go take a nap.
Any more beer?
Sorry. I put it on the list for Dex.
He grunted some response, then went back to the living room, this time taking a seat in Dex's armchair to watch the show. Allegra, grateful the curtains and blinds were closed, returned to the kitchen, rearranging the dishes in the cupboards, trying to make enough racket that it would cover any noise that Trevor might make climbing out the window. 20 minutes later, as she finished scrubbing the sink, she heard what sounded like a snore. She froze. When she heard it again, she turned off the water and stood there for several seconds. There it was again. The third time she heard it, she looked to the back door. It opened to a small patio area and a square of grass, where Trevor used to play when he was little. She'd have to jump the fence to the neighbor's yard and get out that way. Once she found Trevor, they could go for help. She didn't even know if she could actually get over the fence. Still, she had to try, and she started to edge her way toward the kitchen table. All she needed to do was get on the other side of it, open the door. If Frank opened his eyes, he'd be able to see the back door from the armchair. What if he was setting her up? Grabbing a dish towel, she dried her hands, casually walking toward the living room to take a look. Frank's head was tilted back, eyes closed, mouth open. Seconds ticked by. Slowly she started to back toward the kitchen table. She could do this. 3 more steps. 2. 1. As Allegra reached for the handle, the front door burst open. She dropped her hand, looked over, saw Dex carrying 2 bags of groceries. A look of suspicion clouded his face when he noticed her proximity to the back door. Where is he? Dex demanded. Frank woke with a start.
What the?
Allegra's heart was thumping. Dex's eyes bored into hers, and he stalked over to the table, dumped both bags down, one of them spilling onto its side. A yellow onion rolled out across the dark wood tabletop and to the floor. Trevor! Dex called. Her heart beat with every second of silence. He was gone. She wanted to cry with relief, even when Dex pulled out his gun and pointed it at her. She wondered if it would hurt. It didn't matter. Trevor would be safe. I'll kill you for this. Dex raised the barrel toward her.
I'm here.
Trevor stood at the top of the stairs. He glared at Dex.
You want to shoot someone? Go ahead. The neighbors will hear. They'll call for help. Try it.
Shut up and get down here, Dex ordered. Help your mother with the groceries. Allegra's knees started shaking. She grabbed a chair at the table, leaning against it. The tears came. Not because Dex would have killed her, but because Trevor never left. How could he do this to her?
Why? Why wouldn't he listen?
Her son started down the stairs, his expression one of pure anger, and she wondered for a moment if it was directed at her. But when he passed Dex, his back to the man, he looked right at her and mouthed,
I'm sorry.
She reached out, grasped his hand, trying to smile at him. He put his arm around her. Once out of sight of both men, he whispered, I am not leaving you. Ever. Her heart broke a little that night. After dinner, she and Trevor remained at the table while Frank and Dex watched TV, the two men drinking, unfortunately not near enough to inebriate them beyond loose conversation. At one point, Frank lifted his beer, asking, "Whatever this thing is, it can't be hidden in that car." "Probably not," Dex said, "or someone would have found it by now, right?" "Exactly what I was thinking. Bigger question is, how do we find it?" "It's got to be in that diary." "The one you don't have?" "Like I said, we don't need it. My kid's got one of those memories like a computer. I swear he remembers everything." "Trev," he shouted, "get out here." Trevor looked at her, worried. "I don't know anything about where it's hidden," he called out. As much as she'd wished that Trevor had left that afternoon, she realized that he'd grown up, taken responsibility for something he believed in. Her. She smiled, trying to will what little strength she had to him so that he could also fight this battle. "Tell them what you read. It keeps them happy." He reluctantly rose and walked into the front room. "Where do you want me to start?" "Where'd we leave off?" Dex asked. Frank drained the last of his beer, then set the empty bottle on the table. "I think that Peyton fellow was captured. He was trying to use that hidden dagger to get away, but someone took it from him." Chapter 64. Journal of Jonathan Peyton, 5th Viscount Wellswick, 1906. All hope seemed lost as I waited to feel the dagger thrust into my back. Imagining death had never been this frightening. It was mere seconds, but so many thoughts flitted through my head. The atrocities my cousin had committed, and that he was behind the robbery. I thought of the poor engineers, as well as the hired detective who'd lost their lives at my cousin's hand. I thought of Miss Atwater, and prayed she would somehow escape to safety. All this while I braced myself for the dagger to come down toward me. But instead of pain, I felt it sawing the rope. "Don't move," someone whispered in my ear, though I barely heard it over the pounding of my heart. Whoever it was draped the rope over my wrists, then disappeared into the shadows. Reggie returned inside, eyeing me, squinting as he examined the rope at my feet and hands. "How'd you loosen that?" I forced myself not to look behind me. "What?" "Reggie." My cousin held the lantern aloft, his expression scathing. "Reginald. I've always hated the name Reggie." "Please. You're not like this. Think of your wife. Your son." "That's exactly who I'm thinking of." He straightened, looked behind him, the gray ghost now on the bed of the lorry. "Eddie, Mac, leave the car and get rid of my cousin. Make it look like an accident. Finley, take the reins. Time to go." Reginald, don't do this. Please." Reggie ignored me as Eddie jumped down from the back of the lorry, drawing a knife from his waistband as he stalked in my direction. Mac joined him, while Reggie held the lantern aloft. Eddie lifted the blade, the flickering lantern flame reflecting on the cold steel. "Two against one," came a voice from behind me. "That's hardly fair." Mac and Eddie stopped in their tracks, both men looking around, trying to find the source of the voice. "Who's there?" Reggie asked, holding the lantern higher as he searched the warehouse. "The name's Isaac Bell." Mr. Bell stepped out into the light, walking toward us, until he stood between me and my would-be murderers. Dressed all in white, he held my father's brass-handled cane. The hidden blade returned to its sheath. He looked at Reggie, then turned his attention toward Mac and Eddie. "And the lot of you are under arrest for train robbery." The shock on Eddie and Mac's faces lasted a few seconds, before both burst out laughing. Eddie pointed his dagger toward Mr. Bell. "Followed us all the way from New York, did you? By yourself. Aren't you the funny bloke?" He took a step forward.
Isaac Barrow blocked his path with my father's cane. Sorry, I can't let you do that. Eddie, knife in one hand, grabbed the cane with the other, using it to pull Isaac toward him. His leer twisted the scar on his cheek as he glared at Mr. Bell. I'll slit your throat and shove your fancy stick in after it. Will you now? Isaac said, taking a half step back. Eddie held tight to the cane. As Isaac ran his left hand down the cane's shaft, gripping the handle with his right, I thought he'd pull out the blade. But no. He leaned in, drove the cane forward, rammed the man with his shoulder. Eddie's dagger flew from his hand, sliding across the wood plank floor. As Eddie staggered back, Isaac swung the cane around, striking Mac in the chest with the heavy handle, bringing him to his knees. Reggie aimed his gun at the detective. Isaac pivoted, swinging the cane again, knocking the pistol from his hand. Reggie started to reach for it, but Isaac kicked the pistol away, swung the cane against Eddie's spine, knocking him into Mac. Even then the three men sought to attack, but Isaac pressed the cane's catch, drawing the hidden dagger from the handle. Perhaps I wasn't clear enough, Isaac said as he shoved the point toward Mac's throat, stopping just as it drew blood. You're under arrest. The sound of an approaching horseman caught their attention. Isaac was the only one who didn't look, his attention on the three men. Get the gun, Peyton! The moment I grabbed the pistol and pointed it at them, my cousin ran out the door. I say, Reggie! I recognized my friend Byron's voice. He'd gotten my message. Where's Peyton? Reggie raced past, climbing up onto the lorry. Go! Go! Finlay shook the reins. The lorry lurched forward, the wheels squeaking beneath the weight of its load. They're getting away, I called out as Byron dismounted, clearly not understanding. Isaac quickly assessed the situation. Watch these two, Peyton. Shoot if you have to. Isaac ran out, grabbed the reins of Byron's horse, mounted, and raced off after the lorry. I held the gun pointed at the two, my fears of being left in charge turning my stomach. This was not me. I was the last person meant to be a hero. Even so, I realized that if either of these two men tried to escape, I would have to shoot them or let them go. Not wanting anyone's death on my conscience, I saw the rope. Byron, we need to tie these two. Quick. Now. Now, I ordered, before I lost all nerve. Byron nodded, grabbing the rope that had been used to hogtie me, securing it around their wrists. Certain that wouldn't be enough, I told them to wrap it around their waists so that they were back to back. What in heaven's name did they do? Byron asked. Robbed a train. Byron looked over at me, his astonishment evident. The robbery, where the engineers... His face paled. They were murdered! Go get a night watchman, I said, and tell him to bring help. Byron stood, eyed the two men who were struggling against their bonds. Do you think it wise I should leave you? In truth, the last thing I wanted was to be left alone. With no other choice, I pretended a bravado that I did not possess. I really don't want to kill these two, but I will if they try to escape. Both men stilled, eyeing me in turn, the pistol in my trembling hand. Byron nodded. I'll be back shortly. When he left, the quiet of the place terrified me. I thought of Miss Atwater. If I felt like this, what must she feel? What have you done with Miss Atwater? I demanded. Both men refused to answer. Where? The man called Mac gave a cynical laugh. You're alone. Your cousin tells us you're a coward, afraid of your own shadow. Let us go now, and we'll be gentle on you. I felt a bit hot under the collar at his words, not just because Reggie had talked about me to these cutthroats, but because they were true. I was a coward. I glanced at the dagger from my father's cane, recalling how Mr. Bell had used it on Mac, immediately gaining his compliance. Of course, it had a lot to do with how he'd wielded the cane prior, but I was fairly certain I could at least put the point to someone's throat. Keeping a wide berth, I circled the two men, picked up the cane's dagger, then approached, pointing it and the pistol at them. Both my hands were shaking. "Where is Miss Atwater?" I demanded. The two men stared straight ahead. Overcoming my cowardice, I looked at Eddie's scar, placed the tip of my blade against his other cheek. "Lest you want this side of your face to match the other," I said, trying to sound as threatening as Mr. Bell. "You'll tell me what I want to know. You're as mad as your cousin." "Where is she?" I shouted. My hand shook so much the blade pierced his skin, bringing forth a drop of blood. A mere 2 days ago I might have drawn back in horror, but I pictured Miss Atwater, frightened and alone, and I pressed harder. "Where?" "We don't know," Max said. I kept the blade at Eddie's cheek, applying more pressure. Eddie's eyes widened in surprise, and perhaps with a bit of fear. He said he was taking her to the Dowager cottage. I lowered the blade, shocked. 'Twas my grandmother's cottage, empty until Reggie had moved in with his wife and child. Before I had a chance to question him further, Byron and two night watchmen arrived. They took both men away, leaving Byron and me to wait for Mr. Bell. And just when I was about to give up hope, I heard the clip-clop of horses' hooves and the squeak of the lorry's wheels. Mr. Bell was driving the lorry, Byron's horse in tow. Bell tossed the reins to Byron, dragged Reggie from the floorboard, and deposited him at my feet. His hands tied at the back, Reggie started to rouse, apparently having been knocked unconscious. "Where's the other man?" I asked. "The driver. I'm afraid he didn't make it. Not too bright, that one. What about your two?" "Night watchman took them." I told him what I'd learned about Miss Atwater. "Good," he said, as Reggie started to look around. "What now?" I asked. Isaac pulled Reggie up by his shoulder, dragging him so that he was seated, his back to a workbench. "We find out who hired your cousin." "I don't understand." "I suspect your cousin was a pawn to whomever set out to ruin Rolls-Royce. He took advantage of his connection to you and the company to steal the 40-50. His words stunned me, since it meant that I was also a pawn. Mr. Bell must have noticed my expression. "All is not lost, Peyton. Chess happens to be one of my specialties." Reggie glared. "I'll never cooperate." Isaac Bell spared him a look and gave him a dismissive smile. He walked me to the door, his voice low. "I intend to question him further. I'd like to know what happened to the rest of the money stolen during that train robbery." "It wasn't in the chest," I asked. "I saw them loaded onto the lorry." "At least half of the money's missing. I'd say half a million. No doubt hidden away." "Then what was in the chest?" I asked. "Engine parts. To get the Silver Ghost up and running." It didn't occur to me until that moment how devious Reginald's plan had been. With the Grey Ghost missing, and no parts to spare, Rolls-Royce would never get the Silver Ghost finished in time for the Olympia Motor Show. Yet one more blow to the company we'd invested everything in. If not for Mr. Bell, Reggie's attempt to ruin Rolls-Royce would have succeeded. About to leave, I gave my cousin a parting glance, recognizing his smug look. "You know where that money is, don't you?" I asked. His expression darkened, his smile cruel. "Since you helped me hide it, that makes you complicit." "I did no such thing." "You're a fool if you think otherwise." Horrified at the thought, I racked my brain, trying to determine if there was any possibility that I might have taken part in his dastardly plans. I could think of nothing, and looked to Mr. Bell for guidance. "Perhaps," Bell said, "you should determine if Miss Atwater is safe." "And what of him?" I asked, nodding toward Reggie.
As I said, your cousin is only part of the equation. I intend to use him to find out who was really behind the theft of the Grey Ghost.
Reggie's face twisted with triumph and hate.
Perhaps you didn't hear me. I don't plan on cooperating.
Fortunately, I don't require your cooperation.
Bell's smile had a rather devious edge to it.
In fact, I don't even require you to be conscious.
Chapter 65. The plan was simple. Once inside the office, Remy would come up with a way to find out the location of the warehouse holding the Grey Ghost, while Sam acted as lookout. Oliver and Chad would wait in a car, ready to pick the Fargos up for a quick getaway. At the moment, Chad was finding a suitable place to park that wasn't too far. Remy, Oliver, and Sam were seated on a bench in the shade of a chestnut tree, Remy reading up on the import-export business on her phone. A row of motorbikes parked in front of them offered some cover, just in case anyone in Rossi's building across the street happened to look their direction. Oliver eyed the windows across the street.
"Are you sure this is a good idea?" he asked. "Those are armed guards in that lobby."
"They're for the bank," Sam said. "After what happened at the villa, I'm more worried about what Remy might find upstairs in Rossi's offices."
Oliver shifted nervously.
"All the more reason not to go."
"We'll be fine. Remy's got quite the knack for pretending to be something she's not." She looked up from her phone.
"If that's supposed to be a compliment, Fargo, you've missed the mark."
He leaned toward Oliver and in a stage whisper said,
"She's very good at subterfuge. Sneaky operations," he quickly added.
"Better," she said, returning her attention to the phone.
"What if something goes wrong?" Oliver asked. "Bad enough my uncle's in jail for something he didn't do. I couldn't bear it if something happened to either of you."
"We'll be fine," Sam assured him. "Just make sure you and Chad are ready with the car. We might have to leave in a hurry." Chad walked up a few minutes later. "I finally found a place to park." He pointed down the tree-lined street, the patisserie on the corner. It was the closest available.
"It'll do," Sam said.
Remy dropped her phone in her purse, then stood.
"I think I have all I need to know."
If anything, Oliver looked even more worried.
"You couldn't have read through it but once."
"Good memory," Sam said. He looked at her. "Ready?" She leaned over and kissed him.
"See you soon."
Remy smiled at the security guard before announcing her appointment at the Rossi Export Management Company. The guard looked her over, then buzzed her into the lobby.
"Third floor," he said.
She took the elevator up, walked into the shipping company, her expression somber, her head tilted at just the right angle to imply a certain haughtiness that demanded immediate attention.
"Mr. Rossi, please," she said to the receptionist, a woman in her 20s, her blonde hair pulled back in a ponytail.
"And you are?"
"Rebecca Longstreet. My U.S. attorney should have called to arrange a meeting. Short notice, but I'm only in the country until this evening."
"Regarding?"
"SRF import-export."
Remy strode into the middle of the office, giving the place a thorough perusal.
"Who's in charge?"
"Monsieur Marchand."
Remy gave her a blank stare. A look of confusion crossed the young woman's face.
"Did you need to speak to him?"
"If he's not expecting me," Remy said, "he should be."
"Of course. One moment, please."
The woman rose from her seat, knocked on the door behind her, opened it, then disappeared inside. A moment later she returned, holding the door open for Remy.
"Monsieur Marchand can spare you 5 minutes."
As Remy walked in, a portly man in his 50s pushed his chair back and stood, his smile wide as he held out his hand.
"Mademoiselle Longstreet, please, come in. Sit. May I get you a drink?"
"No, thank you."
He walked around his desk, holding the chair for Remy.
"To what do I owe the pleasure?"
"A slight falling out with my former logistics company manager, and a need for an immediate replacement."
"What sort of volume does your company handle, mademoiselle?"
"About 20 or so fewer full containers a month than last year, but I'm hoping that once we speed up the freight process, we'll double that load."
She cleared her throat, started to speak, smiled.
Actually, I will take that offer of a drink.
Of course. One moment. When he walked out the door, Remy saw a stack of papers on a low file cabinet in the corner next to the window. She quickly walked over, looked out the open curtains, saw a glimpse of the Seine between